that we make the wrong choice time and again. If we start training ourselves to be content with the food we require, whether that food is a salad or a steak, we begin to grow into healthy, mature eaters. A slice of advice. Dear Candace, I remember watching you on Full House and learning so much from each episode as a kid. Not only have you been a role model, but there have been so many things that you went through on the show that I've been through in real life. At one point, I even had a struggle with eating and thinking the same things that DJ did. Recently, I found out that you were a Christian, and your testimony just really touched my heart. I'm in college and hoping to get into the entertainment industry for set design. At the same time, I'm so afraid that I will not be able to stand my ground in what I believe and do what I need both career-wise and spiritually. Can you give me some tips that have helped keep you firm and strong in your career? God bless. Leslie. Dear Leslie, I hope school is going well for you. I loved your question. How can you stand firm in your faith while working in the entertainment industry? It's simple. There's no difference between the entertainment industry and any other job you might have. You'll always run into people who don't share the same point of view, who don't believe in God, who believe in other gods, and who will think you're silly for loving Jesus. I realized when I went back to work that no matter where you are, what career you have, whether you're a student or a mom of five, that as a Christian, you have a wonderful opportunity to be a light in this world to others. Simply do your job well with a joyful heart, doing your work for the Lord. Be kind to your coworkers and boss so that they see a difference in you and want to know what it is. That's part of what being a Christian is all about. Take the time to share your faith with others. And if they aren't open to the discussion, allow Jesus to shine through you in your efforts at work. My new show isn't a Christian show, but it doesn't mean I'm not doing the work and will of my Father every day I'm there. My tips are to start your day off in prayer, inviting the Holy Spirit in each morning and putting on the armor of God as found in Ephesians 6, 10 through 18. Candace. A pinch of practicality. If you've lost weight or you want to maintain, make sure your clothing fits well, or alter any clothing that doesn't. Don't hang on to the large sizes because it only gives you an excuse to put the lost weight back on. It's one thing to have a few comfy sweatpants for days you feel bloated, but don't keep a pair of oversized jeans. If you dropped a few sizes, there isn't any reason the size 12 should still be hanging around unless you expect to return to that size. Clean out the old clothes and believe that this change is for good. Give them to your favorite charity or send them off to a friend, but get them out of your sight. If the big clothes are gone and your pants start to feel snug, you won't have anything to fall back on. The only choice you'll have is to buckle down on bad habits again. Maintaining is a lot easier than letting 10 pounds creep up and having to go at it all over again. Food for thought. A recap of scripture to meditate on. For I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. Philippians 4, 11 and 12. A devout life does bring wealth, but it's the rich simplicity of being yourself before God. Since we entered the world penniless and will leave it penniless, if we have bread on the table and shoes on our feet, that's enough. 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 8, The Message. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show men they are fasting. I tell you the truth, they have received their reward in full. Matthew 6, 16. The candy dish. Restaurants with peppermills the size of fire extinguishers and big red menus with the entrees spelled with F's instead of S's are always expensive. Miss Piggy, Miss Piggy's Guide to Life. From My Stove to Yours. French toast. Serves four. Ingredients. Four large eggs. A quarter cup crushed pineapple. 4 to 6 slices of cinnamon raisin bread or whole wheat. A quarter teaspoon cinnamon. Cooking spray. Cottage cheese or berry jam. Directions. Whisk the eggs and stir in pineapple and cinnamon. Add the bread slices and turn them in the mixture to soak for about 30 seconds per side. Coat a non-stick skillet with cooking spray and set over medium to high heat. Once the pan is hot, add the bread slices and cook until golden brown, about 2 to 3 minutes per side. Serve warm with syrup or cottage cheese and berry jam. Chapter 15, A House Swept Clean. It had been several years since the bad habits were put to rest. I was making good choices, controlling my portions, and attending to the needs of my health. Finally, my spiritual life was right on track. I was getting stronger as a Christian, and together as a family, we were learning about the Lord. We had moved to the East Coast where Val was playing hockey with the Florida Panthers, and we had settled into a place we called home. Val had started attending church with us, and I was digging into the Word. I was studying the Bible, learning who God is, and listening to His voice in my life. Things were going strong for me spiritually. But for whatever reason, unknown to me at the time, I was back in a desert of testing. The lure of the pantry was calling my name while Val was on the road, and I returned to the food to find comfort. I found myself stuffed, and with that stuffed feeling also came the feeling of shame. I had done so well for so many years, and again, I was gripped by an appetite that was ruling my head. The cycle of sneaking late-night snacks was back and consumed my thoughts in a matter of days. I knew it wasn't good for my body, but passion trumped wisdom time and again. After a while, it didn't matter if I was filling some sort of void or not. I just found comfort in food. I didn't really want Val to know I had fallen off track, so I'd usually pull out the snacks when he wasn't around. There was no logical reason I did it, other than the fact that it had a grip on me. Why was this returning? And why was it worse than it had been for years? When an evil spirit comes out of a man, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, "I will return to the house I left." When it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept clean, and put in order. Then it goes and takes with it 7 other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that man is worse than the first. That is how it will be with this wicked generation. Matthew 12:43-45. This parable illustrates the difference between a moral reformation and a spiritual transformation. I had been living a moral life for as long as I could remember. I had put my bad habits away. But it wasn't until I realized my behavior was nothing less than sin that I finally saw gluttony in its true light. My house was swept clean and put in order. Bad habits were put away, but a spiritual battle was yet to be won. God was requiring more of me. Being good wasn't good enough. If I was to really be transformed by the Spirit as I was seeking to be, He wanted every area of my life to be handled in a spiritual way. I was learning the important lesson that morality is weak, but the Spirit is strong. I was struggling with something that I couldn't manage on my own. I didn't feel right, but regardless of that, I continued to do it. I didn't want to do it. I had to do it. I hated being that person I saw in the mirror, sneaking around, losing control, gaining what I thought was control. Sound familiar? I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. Romans 7:15. Satan clearly knew my weakness, and God allowed him to explore that weakness and tempt me with it. I was a mess, hiding snacks and sneaking sweets late at night. Here I was striving to learn about God, loving my new relationship with Him, and my passion was in a battle for control of my spirit. Ice cream was in supply, and I was in bondage to food. I wanted to get back on track. I saw how great Val was with self-control, and I couldn't understand why I was faced with a struggle that came so easy to him. I hadn't talked in great detail with him about it. Being that he was an athlete, I didn't know if he could really understand. He excelled in self-discipline, and I lacked self-control. It came to a halt one Sunday when Val was on the road playing a hockey game, and I was at church with the kids. They were in Sunday school while I listened to our pastor speak. I don't recall what the sermon was about, but I do remember that by the end of it, I had started to cry. Hard. It was the kind of sermon that grabbed hold of my heart, and I knew it was time to listen. God was speaking to me. I couldn't help myself, but he was willing and able to help. Minutes later, I was standing in front of our pastor with tears streaming down my face. "Candace, what's the matter? Do you want to talk?" he asked. "Yes, I do," I replied. "I need help." I felt that this stronghold was hindering my growth. I didn't know why it was happening or where it had come from, but I knew I couldn't find freedom on my own. We talked, and I listened while he explained. What I was doing was physical, yes, but my spiritual battle needed to be handled in a spiritual way. I was a blossoming Christian, bringing our family to church. 5 people in my house were learning to serve the Lord, and Satan wasn't about to let that pass without a struggle. "Now that you're walking in faith," he said, "Satan is using your weakness to discourage you, to pull you away and destroy your testimony." I did feel discouraged. I had been doing so well for so long, but somehow I had gotten off track. Getting off track seemed easy, but getting back on was a war I couldn't win on my own. Our pastor suggested I talk to a friend of theirs who had once battled the same struggle. Stacy and I had lunch, compared stories, and shared our faith. It felt great to talk to someone who went through it and had conquered it with Jesus. "Candace, I know in your heart you love the Lord," she said. "But do you know that what you're doing is sin?" Her words gave me a new perspective on things. I'd always viewed my appetite and the struggles it caused as being a moral issue, having never understood the spiritual battle I faced. What I was doing was sin. My house was swept clean, but there was still plenty of dirt hiding under the rug. Now that I was living and walking in the Spirit, God knew that weakness was still present. He knew that the battle had not been won. Satan took that opportunity to sift me like wheat, and God allowed it so that the victory would be his. I knew that abusing my body with food was a bad habit for me, but since I wasn't hurting anyone else, I hadn't seen it as sin. I finally understood. He created me. My body is a temple to be used by him and for him. He desires that we seek a spiritual transformation, not merely a moral one. That talk hit me as nothing before had done. I wanted nothing to do with sin that is willfully and knowingly wrong. That was it. The urge remained for a while, but I refused to sin against God. Instead, I would pray, "I love you, God. Help me to walk away from food. Through you, I have freedom of choice." I walked through many weeks both believing and saying that prayer. To this day, I don't struggle with food as I once did. But if the thought ever popped into my head, I know that there isn't anything Jesus himself hasn't been tempted with and yet remained sinless. God won't give me more than I can handle and always provides a way for escape. I choose that escape when I walk away from the fridge. I have a choice. I can open the tub of ice cream, or I can walk into another room and read a book. I have choices, and I keep it in check by making the right ones. I want to please God. I want him to be happy with me, and I want to be a good servant to him. That is my goal. After I talked with my pastor and met with Stacy, I wanted to share my struggles with Val. I felt vulnerable. Would he get it? Would he understand how much I lacked self-control and how difficult this journey might be for me? His father, who smoked for years, went to his doctor who said, "Quit smoking or you may have a heart attack." That was it. No patch, no weaning, no nothing. He quit. It was as simple as that. Val has that same level of self-control. For him, self-control seems to come easy, and I was concerned he might expect that level from me. I explained to him what a struggle this was in my life. He didn't have the response I was expecting at all. Instead, he listened to my struggle with sympathy. He was happy I shared it with him, and I was happy too. He said he would pray with me and help me along the way. I felt disgusted, unhealthy, and out of control. But now I wonder if perhaps God allowed me to walk through this fire so I'd be equipped to comfort those who walk through it too. I can say that I know what you're going through if you're gripped by food. I am finally free, and you can be too. Don't be surprised if you fall off the wagon. Many of us on the health train find it's going well for a while, but then as we're digging deeper into the word, we face a relapse. Be prepared. The enemy is trying to knock us off course. There may be a point where you trip up, fall on your face, and return to bad habits. I've been there. I've done that. Through Christ, we can dust ourselves off and get back in the race. Even when we don't believe in ourselves, Jesus believes in us enough to put out his hand and pull us back on track. Many women who have lost weight gain it all back and then some. Of course, they ask themselves, why bother if I just repeat the same cycle? I say because it's different when you're fighting the battle with Christ on your side. Keep a healthy body for him, and you won't fail the same way you did in the past. I'm healthy because I want to be used by God to the best of my ability, and as much as he'll allow me to be used. Health, fitness, and size act to glorify him in my line of work. In my industry, I need to stay in shape and be fit so I can get the types of roles I like and with those roles, glorify him. By doing that, I become a living testimony. The entertainment industry is largely based on vanity. There is a standard I need to keep with each project I do. My goal is not to have an amazing body when I hit the next magazine cover, although that would be nice. It's that in everything I do, including my work, I want to glorify the Lord. Weight loss and health are specific to each one of us. Therefore, we shouldn't be looking beside us for that measuring stick of self-control, size, or beauty. I can't compare myself to Val any more than you should compare yourself to other women at the gym. We're uniquely created, each facing our own set of circumstances and struggles. If you're being tested, I'll tell you why. God is requiring more of you. Being good isn't good enough. If you really want to be transformed by the Spirit, as I hope you're seeking to be, he wants every area of your life to be handled in a spiritual way. The pantry, chocked full of food for thought. The main ingredient. When dealing with bad habits we have, we need to ask ourselves if we are battling a moral or a spiritual issue. If what we are doing is hurting our walk with the Lord, then we need to come to a place of true repentance where we are down on our knees before the Lord asking for forgiveness and help. A slice of advice. Dear Candace, first off, I just want to say what a true blessing you are to me. So thank you so much for your time and great words. Lately, it seems that I have a hard time letting go of the sins I have committed in the past. I know I have been forgiven due to asking God for forgiveness and basically saying that I am sorry, but I still think about things I have done, and it brings me to tears sometimes. I rededicated my life to God a few months back. I've been visiting churches in my area, but it's been hard, trying to back away from worldly things that are out there. I was brought up in a Christian home. My grandfather is a preacher at the church I went to in my hometown, and at age 12, I was saved by asking God to come into my heart and forgive me as a sinner. When I graduated from high school and started college, I started going down the wrong path, and then I would feel guilty and ask for forgiveness. Only a few months ago, I realized I needed to change and start putting God first in everything I do. I know that if we ask God to forgive us, we are forgiven. But how do I shake this feeling of, why did I do that? I have been reading my Bible and I just got the book you recommended, The Way of the Master. Any advice you have would be great. Renee. Dear Renee, thanks for your email. I'm so glad you got The Way of the Master because that's the book I'd recommend reading. I suspect you've never come to a place of godly sorrow. I'm talking in tears, on your knees, over the sin in your life. It's a place so deep inside of you where you understand how offensive you've been toward God. Then understanding what he did for you on the cross and his grace. I know you know all the words and what they mean, but I don't know that you've been affected by it in your soul. It didn't happen for me until I read The Way of the Master. Maybe this will trigger it for you too, or maybe it will be something else. In any case, once you've experienced godly sorrow, you can come to a place of true repentance, asking God to forgive you and turning from your sin. See, it's not just about feeling guilty over it and confessing it, but feeling so sorrowful that you don't want to do it anymore. When you've asked for that forgiveness, it's been given to you. There's no reason to wallow in the guilt. That's not going to do anything. You have to trust that once you're forgiven, you're forgiven. Therefore, my brothers, I want you to know that through Jesus, the forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. Acts 13:38. Move on and move into a right relationship with God. Dig into the Word to get to know him better and what he wants to do with your life. Candace. A pinch of practicality. Stop beating yourself up over the mistakes you've made and start rewarding yourself for the good choices you make. One way to do this is by keeping a jar close by into which you drop a coin each time you make a conscious effort that benefits your body, soul, or spirit. You'll discover that the little choices we make add up quickly. Decide to use the money at the end of each month to reward yourself in some way. With the money you've saved, buy a pair of earrings, a lip gloss, or, if you've saved enough, a great pair of jeans. It will make you feel good and encourage you to make wise decisions more often. Food for thought. When an evil spirit comes out of a man, it goes through arid places seeking rest and does not find it. Then it says, "I will return to the house I left." When it arrives, it finds the house unoccupied, swept clean, and put in order. Then it goes and takes with it seven other spirits more wicked than itself, and they go in and live there. And the final condition of that man is worse than the first. That is how it will be with this wicked generation. Matthew 12:43-45. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. Romans 7:15. The candy dish. Great effort is required to arrest decay and restore vigor. One must exercise proper deliberation, plan carefully before making a move, and be alert in guarding against relapse following a renaissance. Horace, Roman poet. From my stove to yours. Lemon and dill baked salmon. Serves four. Ingredients: 8 thin slices fresh lemon, 4 6 to 8 ounce skinless salmon fillets, sea salt and freshly ground black pepper, 2 tablespoons of freshly chopped dill, 1 tablespoon olive oil. Directions: preheat the oven to 375 degrees. Season each salmon fillet with salt and pepper and place in a large 9 by 13 shallow baking dish. Lay 2 lemon slices on top of each fillet. Mix oil and dill and pour over the salmon. Bake for 10 to 15 minutes. Chapter 16. It is well with my soul. I'll never forget that morning, how the cold air felt around me, while the warmth of God's hand waxed my soul. We went in for the pre-op appointment and met with the surgeon. It was the first time he was able to look at the CT scans and provide us with an informed analysis. In our previous meetings, he went off the reports, but that morning, after closely reviewing the films, he was able to give us the full diagnosis. It wasn't good. We were looking at a cholesteatoma, which is a cystic mass or an accumulation of dead cells, much like a tumor, in the middle ear. Unfortunately, the cholesteatoma was not in the early stages and had in fact been there for a while. It was quite large. If left untreated, the mass would cause permanent deafness and move on to other areas of the body, including the brain. When he told us that they would have to do a much more invasive procedure that would involve not only removing the cholesteatoma, but also cutting out much of the cartilage, causing a wide open hole in our little boy's ear that would be prone to serious infection. If this was to be done, Lev would never be able to get his ear wet or swim again for the rest of his life. At 4 years old, Lev was already a master diver, and so the thought of separating him from the water he loved so much was heartbreaking for us. The doctor also warned us 3 times, saying, "Be prepared for the possibility of facial nerve damage, because the size of the cholesteatoma has severely wrapped itself around those nerves." It was an emotionally exhausting day, preparing for the worst, yet hoping for the best. I would have loved to have heard better news, but his words didn't fall in our favor. Lev is my saving grace. He's tender-hearted, sensitive, and truly has a heart for God. Some say he's the spitting image of me with his little round nose and almond-shaped eyes. Regardless of how much effort I do or don't put into growing his faith, he loves the Lord. He's diligent in all that he does, whether it's getting his homework done or his chores. Bright and intelligent, he is a straight-A student, and his teachers never cease to tell me what a joy he is to teach. Like his dad, he's a genetically gifted athlete, competing in tennis and hockey, and playing just about any sport you could possibly imagine. I love his smile. That smile was present the morning we arrived at the hospital. In spite of his condition, his courage shone through, offering a sense of peace to both Val and me. We arrived at 6:30 a.m., he was in surgery by 11:20 a.m., and for the next hour we prayed, patiently, waiting for news. Words can't describe the joy that flooded our hearts the moment the nurse spoke those words. They are performing the lesser of 2 surgeries, and while we waited another hour or so for the doctor to give us the final news, we knew the grace of God was upon us and that Lev would indeed be okay. The surgery went well. The cholesteatoma was large indeed, but they kept working at it and were able to remove it without opening the inner ear canal. There wasn't any facial nerve damage whatsoever, but out of the 3 hearing bones, 2 of them had already been destroyed. They removed those 2 as well as 1/2 of the remaining bone. His little head was wrapped in bandages, and while his body was weak, his spirit was strong. Lev is nearly deaf in his right ear, which is truly the least of our worries. It was an exhausting experience for any parent to go through, but we found comfort in knowing that so many people were praying over Lev and the doctors, and for that we are eternally grateful. Faith and prayer carried us through, along with a sense of peace and assurance that only comes from the Lord, the greatest physician of all. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Philippians 4:6-7. The peace of God has been a lifeline for me over the years. When I'm tired, stressed out, angry, or at the end of my rope, I try my best to remember, "It is well with my soul." I know that regardless of what I am put through on earth, my spirit cannot be touched. I can rest in that knowledge because I am safe in his arms. He is my shield. Say the word affliction, and you can't help remembering the Israelites. They finally fled Egypt, leaving a life of slavery behind them, and before they knew it, Pharaoh was hot on their tail. God hardened the heart of Pharaoh, knowing that he would pursue them, and as a result was able to show his power to save. Imagine it this way. Say you make a decision to live well today. You decide that you're going to start eating well, and you plan to walk 30 minutes every day starting tomorrow. You've decided that you've lived in bondage to food far too long, and you want to leave it behind in search of the promised land, a land flowing with milk and honey, where you are free from the pull of the fridge door, and you are in the groove of a fitness routine. So you wake up in the morning ready to take on the world, but before you do, things start to fall out of place. Nothing works out as you planned. Stress is on the rise. And as the problems begin to accumulate, your day is thrown into a spin and your plans along with it. That's when you just might decide in your heart, I didn't expect to deal with all of this right now. It's too much. I'm tired. I'm stressed. And all I can think of is sinking my teeth into the nearest loaf of French bread and zoning out on the couch. I'm better off returning to the life I had. After all, it was never really that bad. This thought has been echoed throughout the ages, starting way back as far as Exodus 14, 11, and 12, when the Israelites said, "What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, 'Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians'? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert." When you are standing in the desert of testing with your back to the sea and all you can see in front of you is the enemy closing in, be still. Stand firm and you will find deliverance. Have you ever stood still long enough to witness God do his work? Have you ever stood still in his presence and let him fight your enemy? Be still. Because when you do, God will triumph over your enemy, release you from your stronghold, and you will know that he is God. God hardened Pharaoh's heart so he would pursue the Israelites. But when he did, God not only rescued his people, but he also sabotaged the pursuit of the Egyptians by removing their chariot wheels and finally covering them with the sea. Can you hear the sound of the Israelites rejoicing at the sight? Can you hear the sound of your own voice rejoicing when you press on in faith and let God destroy the enemy that you leave behind? I absolutely love reading stories from the Old Testament because there is so much to glean from them. The events they live through typify my walk with Christ in so many ways, so many. Whether they are about slavery in Egypt, the time spent in the wilderness, crossing the Red Sea, or entering the Promised Land. Those stories teach us lessons that we can apply to our lives today. Each lesson shows the power of God so that we might have hope for today. Hope. Did you hear that? That we might have hope. There is a desert of testing. I won't deny that or sugarcoat it in any way. It will be hard before it gets easy. In fact, it is often God's style to wait until the storm is at its fullest before he commands the waves to cease. That's how we learn to lean on him. If it was easy, we'd all be model thin and run 3 miles a day. Life isn't easy, but that's okay. Let that thought sink in for a minute. Life isn't easy, but that's okay. In fact, it's better than okay when we consider the maturity it brings to our souls. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. James 1:2-4. God desires to triumph over our enemies. He desires to rescue you from your stronghold. He desires to lead you to the promised land. Will you let him? Perseverance takes patience, a characteristic that most of us lack. 2 weeks at a gym and women are discouraged that the weight isn't coming off yet. Even a slow computer can get us in a tailspin. Life takes time. We need to remember that. It takes time. If you give up and return to Egypt at the first sign of trouble, you're missing out on blessings God has to offer. You're missing out on the promise he gives to trample our enemies under his feet. What happens at the second sign of trouble? If you plateau for a week, 2 weeks, or a month, If it rains just as you plan to go out for a walk, every time, will you, like the Israelites, grumble once again, longing for the day when you ate all of the bread you wanted? That's what they did. Even after crossing the Red Sea, a miracle we can barely imagine, let alone feel beneath our feet, they wanted to return to slavery because they were hungry and too impatient to wait on God for their food. Not unlike us. C.S. Lewis wrote, "A silly idea is current that good people do not know what temptation means. This is an obvious lie. Only those who try to resist temptation know how strong it is. A man who gives in to temptation after 5 minutes simply does not know what it would have been like an hour later. That is why bad people, in one sense, know very little about badness. They have lived a sheltered life by always giving in." He speaks to the weakness many of us face from time to time. We become the 5 minute girl, giving in to temptation left, right, and center. Perhaps it's lack of sleep, which is a popular reason we hang off the wagon while our feet drag on the ground, or it might be a case of stress. Whatever the reason, we return to the food thinking, tomorrow will be a better day, and we believe that it will. If I have learned anything from my experience with trials, it's this. I need to take that step of patience now. Not tonight, not tomorrow, right now. Push the food to the side today. Why? Because it's not going to comfort me the way that I think it will. And guess what? That food will still be there tomorrow. Some might say, it's just food, get real. But no, it's not just food any more than gold is just gold. When your life molds or shapes it into something you idolize or use to tranquilize, it becomes your golden calf. I could have turned to food when Lev was in the hospital. Those hours in the waiting room I could have spent filling my face. But instead, I chose to fast, pray, and fill my heart with the knowledge that God was fighting this battle and that He was in control. How it must pain God when He frees us from slavery, whether it be to food, alcohol, overspending, smoking, binging, purging, whatever our stronghold is, only to find us returning to it once again, hoping to find tranquility, excusing the struggle we have with our weakness so we can worship and cling to the calf once again. God doesn't always provide the easy way out. He doesn't promise that life will be a breeze or free of temptation. In fact, temptation is something we can always expect. But what He does promise us is this. He'll always provide a way to escape. There's always a way out, a better way to escape from our pain. And with a little soul searching and determination, a way to leave the golden calf behind. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of ages has come. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you do not fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. 1 Corinthians 10:11-13. Whenever I've been tempted to run to the bathroom after eating too much, this verse instantly comes to mind. When faced with the truth, knowing that I have another choice because God promised me so, do I take God's hand? Or do I turn my back on Him and dive into my sin? I know my decision. What about you? The pantry, chocked full of food for thought. The main ingredient. When faced with an overwhelming sense of stress, we have two choices. We can either cling to the golden calf, or we can cling to our Lord. If we make anything our God in this world, we are reshaping our surroundings to be something it's not. There will never be anything that can heal, satisfy, or save like the Lord Jesus can. A slice of advice. Dear Candace, do you have any recommendations that I can do spiritually wise in exercise or nutritionally to reduce general anxiety? Whenever I get anxious, my stomach gets upset. Thanks and God bless. Liz. Dear Liz, absolutely. Obviously, the first thing you can do is cut down on caffeine if you are drinking coffee or cola. Caffeine makes us all a bit edgy. Next up, you might be surprised to learn that carbohydrates can act as a tranquilizer to mellow you out. They increase the amount of serotonin in your brain, which is also something those suffering with depression are often lacking. Reach for complex carbohydrates that will last longer in your system, such as fruit and whole grain breads. Okay, have a piece of dark chocolate too. Also, consider taking a vitamin B supplement. B6 works to raise serotonin levels. Don't let your blood sugar get too low. If you are hungry, you may get tense. If it's not time for dinner, a half ounce of juice can raise your blood sugar and keep you going until dinner. Exercise relieves muscle tension so you feel more relaxed. Even if you only have time for some glute bridges, try to fit a workout in every day. Some people are generally more prone to anxiety, and although we see it as a bad thing, it can be a very good thing. How we handle it is another. If you find that you're in a tough spot and you need to relax, lie down flat for a few minutes. Let the feeling of anxiety move through you and thank God that He made you this way. Allow yourself to feel what's going on in your body, knowing that God wired you this way for a purpose. Is your heart racing? Is your stomach growling? Let the feeling move through you freely. Don't try to fight it. Just let it flow. It's God's work in progress healing your pain. Start saying, "It is well with my soul." Just saying the words out loud sets your mind in a different direction. Candace. A pinch of practicality. Patience comes with patience. In other words, the more you exercise it, the more you obtain it. We definitely weren't born patient. In fact, most of us come out kicking and screaming. But with guidance and, here's that word again, patience from our parents, we learn to wait, to tolerate, and to accept certain things, many things. Mindfully tolerate the small things in life by biting your lip when need be, smiling under pressure, or forgiving others' imperfections. Try to exercise more of these moments throughout the day. Place 100 pennies in a cup on the counter. Each time you exercise patience throughout the day, move one penny from the full cup to the empty cup. The goal is to eventually move all of the pennies from one cup to the other. This exercise represents the giving of ourself to others, as Christ has freely given to us. Food for thought. A recap of scripture to meditate on. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Jesus Christ. Philippians 4, 6 and 7. What have you done to us by bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we say to you in Egypt, "Leave us alone, let us serve the Egyptians"? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. Exodus 14, 11 and 12. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work, so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. James 1, 2 through 4. These things happened to them as examples and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, He will also provide a way out so that you can stand up under it. 1 Corinthians 10, 11 through 13. The candy dish. That which causes us trials shall yield us triumph, and that which makes our hearts ache shall fill us with gladness. The only true happiness is to learn, to advance, and to improve. which could not happen unless we had comment with error, ignorance, and imperfection. We must pass through the darkness to reach the light. Albert Pike. From my stove to yours. Fantastic breakfast oatmeal. Serves two. Ingredients. 1 cup old-fashioned Quaker oats. 1 3/4 cups of water. 1/2 cup raisins. 1/4 cup canned pumpkin. 2 tablespoons ground flaxseed. 1 teaspoon cinnamon. 1/4 cup milk, optional. Directions. Combine water, raisins, and pumpkin and bring to a boil. Stir oats into boiling mixture. Cook for 5 minutes over medium heat, stirring occasionally. Add flaxseed and cinnamon. Cover, remove from heat. Let stand until desired consistency. Spoon oatmeal into bowls. Pour milk over oatmeal, optional. Chapter 17. Is meekness a weakness? Way back in the day, before diapers, bottles, and stretch marks, Val and I bought an adorable yet mischievous Valentine gift. Emma, a blonde Cocker Spaniel. We went to a breeder hoping to adopt a pup, and that's where we first met her. There was something endearing about Emma. One look at her adoring hazel-colored eyes, long floppy ears, and playful disposition was enough for us to know she was ours. We chose the name Emma because it had a romantic ring to it, like Emily, but shortened. It rolled off the tongue. In fact, it was much easier to say, Emma, get out of the garbage, or Emma, get out of my purse, than it was to use all 3 syllables 162 times each day. Emma could eat her way through a meat truck and still have a hankering for the gum in my purse. She loved her food and had no off button when she was full. We couldn't leave any leftovers on the table, or she'd jump on the chair and devour everything. We couldn't place garbage anywhere near her, or she'd tip it over when we weren't looking and make her way through it. We couldn't hang candy canes on the Christmas tree unless we wanted to see the tree lying on its side the next day. She was definitely a food hound. I remember one occasion when we had guests staying with us for a week. As per the norm, we briefed our guests on Emma, warning them not to leave one shred of food in their room. In addition to that, we instructed them to keep the door closed any time they were out, or Emma would make her way in. Are you sure you don't have food of any kind? I asked, and they assured me they didn't. Not realizing the potential that Emma had to sniff out and find food, our guests went out for the day, forgetting to close the bedroom door. They returned several hours later to find their suitcases open, clothing strewn around the room, makeup case unzipped, and an empty wrapper licked clean. That granola bar was never seen again. I had to assure them that it wasn't our kids that got in there and ransacked their room. We had no doubt it was a little dog with a huge appetite and a lack of self-control. We saw her do the same with purses. It wasn't uncommon for a friend to reach for her purse only to find the contents removed while Emma ran away with a piece of gum or a cough drop. She would open zippers, unsnap snaps, and unbuckle buckles to get her paws on a morsel of food. Cocker Spaniels are bred to hunt birds, and if they aren't exposed to the outlet for which they are born, they tend to be a little unbridled at times. I wasn't much of a bird hunter, nor had I planned to be, so Emma did her best to occupy herself with as much food as she could find. She could go from empty to way past full in 60 seconds flat. She got into garbage outside, she got into garbage inside, and she filled up on anything and everything she could find. She had the craziest appetite I've ever seen. Each time she got caught, those remorseful eyes tried to convince me she would never do it again, but somehow I suspected she would. Emma was 14 years old last summer, and by that age, she was losing it. She was blind, deaf, and her quality of life was failing her. So with much sadness, we decided to put her down. Our little sweetheart was a curious, active dog with kitten-like paws and long, floppy ears that reflected the free spirit she was. As much work as she was at times, I don't know if I'd have wanted her any other way. In stark contrast to Emma was Sydney. She was a large breed dog with abundant strength. I got Sydney a short while before I moved out of my parents' house. She was my own dog and my responsibility. Our dad wasn't crazy about the idea of us getting a dog because he said the responsibility of taking care of it would eventually fall on him. With all of us kids doing our own thing, he figured he'd be the one walking, feeding, and being the primary caretaker of the dog, and so we opted for reptiles instead. They weren't cuddly pets whatsoever, but they were easy to care for nonetheless. Once I knew that I was getting my own house, my parents also agreed to let me get my own dog. I wanted a Rottweiler because of the security factor, and also because I've always been drawn to that breed. Rottweilers are devoted, obedient, and eager to learn. I went to a breeder to find her, and when the breeder saw how small I was, she was hesitant to sell me the male. That worked out best for me anyway, because Sydney was my first choice. Unlike Emma, who came along later, Sydney was a calm and self-confident dog who tested her surroundings before jumping in with 4 feet. Being a big dog, she preferred to live small, with a bark that was smaller than her bite. She was named after Laura Layton's character, the fiery redhead on Melrose Place. Her black and mahogany coat clothed a large muscular build, a ferocious appearance that was merely skin deep. People would often enter our property from the back to visit my mom's agency, but Sydney was gentle with everyone she met. We trained her to drop each time we said, "Bang!" Pointing my finger, she'd fall back with 4 paws in the air. It was a vulnerable position, especially for that type of dog. But Sydney was self-controlled and loyal at all times. Once we moved out of Mom and Dad's place, Sydney's protective instincts gave me a sense of safety. Because of her exceptional strength, I was careful to bridle her energy with proper training and care. Alongside my efforts, I felt that Sydney put in great effort herself. Sydney was with me when I moved out on my own, through my courtship with Val and through the birth of all 3 of our children. Her protective instincts made her a great family pet alongside Emma. There were times when we were living in Montreal, Canada, when Val was playing hockey with the Canadiens, that I had to board her back in California at my parents' house. Val was on the road a lot, and if I was busy, she would stay there for months at a time. California was always her home away from home. And as much as my dad tried to avoid it, the responsibility of taking care of a dog eventually did fall back on him. But my parents loved Sydney and could hardly resist such a well-trained companion who really wasn't much work. She was gentle with our children and protective when she needed to be. With Val traveling, the kids and I were often alone. We appreciated having a large, protective dog in the house. She was better security than any alarm system could offer. I'd often say, "If anyone wants to break in my house, they have to deal with my dogs." Sydney could sit, roll, and lie down on command. She would twist and perk up her triangular ears when we asked, "Who's there?" She was good on a leash. Meanwhile, Emma would walk alongside her, distracted by the scent of anything that even slightly smelled edible. She was a remarkable companion who shared a good part of our lives. Unfortunately, she was only 10 when she got cancer and soon after died in surgery. When I think of Sydney and Emma, I see the contrast in their personalities, and I discover the benefit that meekness can add to one's character. I found a deeper understanding of meekness and how to apply it to my life. Suddenly, its purpose is clear. Is meekness a weakness? Often we equate the word meekness with words like weak, timid, nervous, shy, frail, feeble, hesitant. Yet when we look closer at the word meek, we find strength under control. The Greek word is priev, translated in Strong's Concordance, number 4239, as mildness of disposition, gentleness of spirit, meekness. True synonyms for the word meek include humble, submissive, gentle, obedient, subservient, modest, mild. So the idea is that a meek person is someone who is gentle, tolerant, patient, long-suffering, and someone who is submissive to God. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Matthew 5:5. Contrary to the way the world would see it, meekness does not equate weakness. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Meekness is being strong, yet controlled. When studying the word, I found that the Greeks often equated meekness with the taming of an animal, such as a horse that was broken in, as opposed to one that is wild. This reminded me so much of Sydney. With incredible body strength, she was capable of doing severe damage, and yet she was the meekest animal I have ever met. We knew she was meek each time she rolled over on her back and played dead. It was one of the most submissive actions an animal of her breed could display. By the time Sydney was a few years old, she was trained to respond well on a leash. While we took her for walks alongside Emma, she quietly kept pace. Emma, on the other hand, wanted the world to know she was there. She liked to be heard and be seen. When approached by other dogs, Sydney remained calm. Knowing she could take most dogs out with one gulp, she chose not to strike back. Instead of retaliating, she remained under control, following the lead of her master. I look to Jesus, whose life was a reflection of his desire to follow the master. He always put the Father's will over his. When he was tempted in the desert, he stayed calm and continued his work. When he was driven out of town by an angry mob who threatened to throw him off a cliff, he chose to leave calmly. He could have called a multitude of angels to his rescue. He could have let emotion overshadow the plan, but he didn't. He remained controlled under pressure, the essence of meekness. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. Isaiah 53:7. And the same meek and gentle Jesus Christ entered the temple area and drove out all who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves. Matthew 21:12. How is that meek? Always ready to defend his faith, yet never defending himself. Therein lies the strength of the meek, in the ability to control one's passions and desires. There is a time when defense is in order, and in the case of the money changers, Jesus was illustrating that lesson. He never defended himself, but he was always ready to defend the Father. Sydney and Emma depicted both meekness and weakness. One was led by unbridled passion, while the other was strength under control. If we learn to control our passions in the small things of life, we equip ourselves to be further controlled in the larger issues. On the other hand, if we let our emotions rule us, we become a slave to them. We know it's not good to eat too much food or to indulge in junk food just because our bodies crave the sugar and salt. Each time we do, we exercise that same uncontrolled passion that Emma displayed. If we don't rule our passions, we leave ourselves open and vulnerable to attack. Jesus equipped himself for ministry by fasting in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, bringing his body under subjection to the Spirit. Can you say no to an extra brownie or two? Can you say no to a soda pop and grab water instead? Each time you let your passions rule your choice, you are letting them rule over you. Isn't that a discouraging thought? Can you imagine how great a force we could be if we could live a life of meekness in the same manner as Jesus? If we could bridle our passion to where the Spirit is taking the lead, We could become a conquering force able not only to reject the next binge, but to stand up for our faith when the going gets tough. If controlling our appetite weren't of great importance, why would fasting be of any